It's our season two finale, y'all, and I've got a doozy for you. This is On a Mission, episode 18. I'm your host, Maline Dupree-Dominguez. I'm a minister, teacher, writer, and general people enthusiast living in the beautiful Bay Area of California. I can't wait to share some of my favorite people with you. For you listeners who read the National Catholic Reporter, my guest likely needs no introduction. Jamie L. Manson wrote the column entitled Grace on the Margins for the newspaper for 12 years. She recently left that post to become the president of Catholics for Choice. We talk about her journey as an out lesbian Catholic journalist. We talk about reproductive health as a human right. We talk about her deep sacramental spirituality. We talk about Pope Francis, who, by the way, does he read Jamie's columns? Take a listen and see what you think. Thank you so much for making time.
Pleasure. Of course. Happy to be here.
So you have recently taken on a huge life transition, going from being a columnist at NCR for 12 years, 12 writing years.
13 now,
13 years, yeah. Writing Grace on the Margins.
Yeah.
And now you are working for Catholics for Choice.
Yes. I'm the president of Catholics for Choice.
You're the president of Catholics for Choice. How's the transition?
It's quite a pivot, I will tell you that, and a very different life change. But I have to tell you, it leadership really suits me. And I have been denied leadership, unfortunately, because some of my readers know I came out in my first column, and I have been always open about being pro-choice, pro-sexual reproductive health, and access to it. And pro women's ordination, and which is still, I think, an excommunicable offense to even speak of on the books. So I had leadership gifts. I had some leadership background, but you know, my talents just got underutilized. So it's been wonderful to be able to finally function, you know, in leadership, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm at 3.5 weeks now, and it's a wild 3.5 weeks since I started with in the heat of Amy Coney Barrett and then got right into the election. So it's been really intense, but really fun.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
What strikes you most just in these 3.5 weeks about what it's like to have your leadership gifts valued?
It's very powerful. It really is. And it calls to mind to me all the Catholic women and Catholic people of marginalized genders who do not get a chance to lead and do not get a chance to speak with authority or act with authority strictly because of their gender and no other reason. And it just drives home to me again the loss to the church. That we can't have the gifts and the abilities of all of these people who are longing to lead and serve in their church.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And may I also just say thank you for your courage to persist for all of these years.
It went fast, but but it is all of these years. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I'm incorrigible. So, and I have often said that I am absolutely convinced I'm right. So
that helps.
I have an insane conviction that I'm right about these things. So I can't shut up about them.
Yeah, that helps. So tell us about how the mission of Catholics for Choice aligns with your personal mission in the world.
Sure. Yeah. In many ways, this is my dream job, because at the root of what we're doing here is the profound misogyny of Catholic doctrine. And the fact that the teachings on marriage, the teachings on contraception, the teachings on abortion, really all boil down to the teachings on LGBTQ people, really all boil down to this theological conviction that the church leaders have, that women are not equal to men and are not deserving of equality. And that not only are they not deserving, but this is how God wants it. This is God's plan for humanity, that women are meant to be, not meant to be leaders or initiative takers, not meant to be priests as a result, and that they're meant to serve, and that their most essential vocation is motherhood. That's at the root of all of these issues. You know, I think the hierarchy likes to say it's about the unborn, but it's really about this profound fear that patriarchy has of women controlling their own bodies and their own fertility. And it's LGBTQ issues. It's again, we're going against God's plan for humanity. And so in our work, one of the big issues we're going to be taking on at Catholics for Choice is about refusals. And the fact that now we have a case in the Supreme Court where another Catholic organization is fighting to strip people of their rights, right? And so this is about this Catholic charity in Philadelphia that's trying to ban LGBTQ people from adopting, right? And whether or not if they take public funds, government funds, they have the right to do that. If you know, given the makeup of our court and given the way these rulings went last year, where the church got the right to fire anyone for any reason in the Marcy Baruch case, where the Little Sisters of the Poor again got the right to deny people contraception, and with that, any corporation the right to provide contraception, you know, they're all rooted in the same thing, you know, the same issues. And so one of the things we're doing at Catholics for Choice is we're going to find these real intersectionalities now, because LGBTQ people are being refused services in the same way women have been refused services for decades, like tubal ligations, like contraception, like abortion. So there's some really interesting overlaps are coming up. And what I want to tell people is I hope it reminds everyone, LGBTQ women, that we're fighting the same ideology. Right. So hopefully we can find some in our shared vulnerabilities, we can find that we stand together and fight for each other. So,
yes, it makes for a larger, wider, broader coalition.
Right. I'm hoping. Mm-hmm.
The misogyny that you name at the root of so many of these issues also seems to be rooted in just a fundamental distrust of people who express anything other than a cis male gender, right?
Right, yeah.
So this case you're talking about is the Fulton versus City of Philadelphia case?
That's correct, yeah.
Tell my listeners why they should care about this Supreme Court case, Fulton versus City of Philadelphia.
Yeah, they should really care, because this is an escalation of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Remember that? Where a guy was fighting for the right to not bake a cake for a same-sex couple. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the next escalation of the issue, because what now the Catholic Church is fighting for is to say, well, just because we take government funds doesn't mean we have to obey, you know, civil law. So we can discriminate. We can take those government funds and we can still discriminate against things that violate basic fundamental civil rights. And that's going to be, if they do get away with it, and, you know, they may very well, especially that we have six Catholic ideologues right now on the bench, that will be, the implications will be massive, because it will mean that the government has no power over its contractors. Right. And think about how many kinds of contractors the government employs to do its work. The government will not have any power to enforce basic civil rights on those contractors, and that those rights are protected. So we see this incredible stripping away of basic rights. It was labor laws in Marcy Baruch. Now it's going to be, you know, basic civil rights, you know, the right to adopt children. And it's just such a shame that this is all being generated by the Catholic Church, and Catholic institutions are the ones that are filing these lawsuits. It's heartbreaking, really, because they have massive implications.
Heartbreaking, indeed.
Yeah.
what do you make of this paradox of having, as you stated, these six Catholic ideologues on the bench of the Supreme Court representing one arm of Catholic community, Catholic life. And now we're looking to get Joe Biden as president, the second Catholic president.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like outsiders might look at us and be like, what is with you people?
Right. Yeah. What is this religion?
So Jamie, what would you say? What is with us people?
Well, it's a testimony to the big tent that Catholicism is, I guess, first and foremost. You know, we have six Catholics on the bench, five are right-wing radical ideologues, and Sotomayor is the sixth, who's actually quite liberal and always forgotten as a Catholic. There's a lot of racism tinged in our forgetting about her. I have to make sure we say that. What to make of it is it's scary because the Supreme Court appointments are lifetime appointments. So we're going to be stuck with the right-wing ideologues for a very long time, where we could maybe only have Joe Biden for 4 years. So that's part of what's worrying. But what strikes me is that Biden appeals to his faith. AOC appeals to her Catholic faith.
Yes.
In talking about why they support these social justice principles, but so does Amy Coney Barrett. You know, so what is this faith? You know, it really speaks of the tension and the paradox that we're dealing with Catholicism and the way in which it's interacting with public policy. Right. And so part of the problem is the media only focuses on the right wing Catholics, yes. Right? And the right wing evangelicals. I'm hoping what we see now with the rise of AOC and now the election of Joe Biden, really talking about the Catholic left, because it used to be a real force in the 70s, you know, with Dan Berrigan, Dorothy Day, 60s and 70s. I'm hoping maybe we'll see a rise up so people don't always just identify Catholicism with this homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic, you know, beast that is the way the bishops and right-wing Catholics depict it as. So that's my hope anyway, as we get to see a whole new face of Catholicism.
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like your role in Catholics for Choice is a big part of that. The writing that you've been doing. Congratulations, by the way, on the recent Washington Post op-ed.
Thanks. That was cool, right? Yeah.
So really cool. Here you come onto the mainstream national scene, representing the Catholic left.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really happy about that. Thank you.
Yeah, congratulations. I'll ask you about that in a sec, but I'm wondering now, how are you, if you are, exhaling from Trump?
Well, we're not rid of him yet, are we? So I'm still holding my breath a little bit because he's such a chaotic figure. And so, and he loves chaos. He thrives on chaos. So it's really interesting. I think I'm still in shock a bit that it's really over, but then I'm like, wait, is it really over? You know, because we don't know, you know, because this is what he thrives on, chaos and disinformation and lies. But, you know, assuming that we do have a peaceful transition of power, and I hope we do. It's just what I'm thinking about as I exhale slowly and cautiously. Is how do we, you know, how do we leverage this moment as progressive Catholics? What does Joe Biden mean for progressive Catholics? You know, because this is a man that goes to Mass every Sunday. I don't go to Mass every Sunday, more faithful than me, you know, but he's espousing these very interesting principles. So that's sort of, I'm kind of in strategy mode of how do we, number one, make sure he keeps to his commitments to being pro-choice, being pro-women, pro-access to reproductive health care. How do we make sure he doesn't backslide on that in any way? You know, and how do we leverage it to really put this new face on Catholicism? As I've said, we are his base. Progressive Catholics are his base. We had a strong hand in getting him elected, as did women of color in Georgia, as did indigenous women in Arizona, you know. But we're in terms of Catholics, we are his base. So, you know, how do we leverage that? That's sort of what I'm strategizing about and thinking about right now as I exhale.
Yeah. In your wildest hopes, What do you hope from Biden?
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah, I mean, for my own purposes, in terms of my work, I hope that he will be bold, in disagreeing with the bishops, and being able to articulate why he's still a Catholic. You know, he'd be doing us all a great service, right? And so that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that he's able to sway more Catholics, that the bishops lose this influence, this strange, disproportionate influence they have on public policy, and that he can fight back. I mean, Obama folded a bit to the bishops when they rose up against the Affordable Care Act and the contraceptive mandate. That was really unfortunate. I get it, because Catholic hospitals are a force. They are a huge lobbying force. And I hope that he won't give in to that. And part of what I like to do is show people the face of what it means to be denied basic health care at a Catholic hospital because you're a woman, or because you need a hysterectomy, or because your life depends on it, and being turned away by a Catholic hospital, and not to let Catholic hospitals and bishops have that kind of power over people's health. So I hope that he can leverage his faith commitment to fight against that. I hope that that ends up being a benefit to him, whereas Obama, I think, wasn't Catholic, right? And maybe felt a bit lost or a bit worried. You know, we'll see what Biden does. So that's my hope.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think you're absolutely right that Obama may have been under-advised, perhaps, about what was really going on there.
Yeah, because people start screaming anti-Catholic bias at him. I saw it. The people at my own newspaper were doing it, and they were driving me crazy, frankly. They're still doing it sometimes. But Biden, they can't claim that, you know, so I'm hoping he uses it as a, you know, for to do something very powerful.
Yeah. You just mentioned reproductive health care as a life-saving necessity. Can you say a little bit more about that? I feel like we don't hear enough about reproductive health care as life-saving health care.
Well, you know, you really see it in a really big way in the Global South, where, first of all, let me state that one in every six hospital beds in the world is owned by the Catholic Church. That's a staggering number, isn't it? So now you think now about poor areas of the Global South. Now think if the only healthcare facility in 100 miles is a Catholic healthcare facility. And let's say you've had seven children, and if you have one more, you are going to bleed to death, right? Or you're going to get a fistula, or something horrible is going to happen. That Catholic health center will not give you what you need. You know, you need contraceptives, you need a tubal ligation, or it's AIDS. You know, AIDS is still a raging pandemic in sub-Saharan Africa. They're still not giving out condoms. It's still the most life-saving measure we have, right? I mean, to preventative measure that we have. They're still not giving that out. We forget about that stuff. And I think part of it is because in this country, you know, from a privileged perspective, well, contraceptives are easy to get here. What's the big deal? That ship has sailed. Catholics don't buy that anymore. Yeah, that's fine if you're white and you're rich or middle class in the U.S., and you can get access to these things. But what do you do if you're in the Philippines and you've had bishops for 15 years blocking you from getting reproductive health care and you're desperately poor? What do you do? These are life or death issues in most of the world. And that's what I really mean. And they are too in the US. How many poor women will lose their contraceptive access that they were supposed to be guaranteed as their right under the Affordable Care Act because the bishop said no? You know, and think about it. No other religion bans contraception. This is bananas. Evangelicals don't. Mormons don't. You know, I mean, this is like such a next level extremist agenda. But, you know, they're able because evangelicals have their own agenda. They will go in cahoots, you know, and support the Catholic Church, even though they don't actually even believe this. And that's what's scary.
Ooh, right? It's a sinister deal with the devil, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's an unholy alliance. And who is it affecting most? Women of color, people of marginalized genders, and the poor. They're the ones that always lose in these ideological battles.
And that's who we're supposed to be defending, right? And protecting at all costs.
Exactly. And the majority of Catholics get that. Their priorities are right. Bishops still aren't. And these very wealthy right-wing Catholics who are funding these legal initiatives, you know. So It's scary, but it is. I want people to understand that access to contraception is a life or death issue here and throughout the global South. So.
Thanks. So treading into the territory of the world church, can we talk about Pope Francis for a minute?
Always, yes.
So you did have a brilliant op-ed recently in the Washington Post, which I will link in our show notes at MaleneDupreeDominguez.com. But tell us about the origins of that op-ed. Why'd you write it?
Well, I was asked to write it, which is wonderful, first of all, and I was thrilled to write it because these are issues I have been talking about for as long as I was a columnist at NCR, you know. And I started as a columnist, Benedict was Pope. It was a very different world when I came out, very different church. But since Francis was elected in March of 2013, I've been talking about this. And that is that, first of all, I'm frustrated with Francis because anything he supposedly says about LGBT, something positive about LGBTQ people, because he does say negative things about it, is always secondhand information through some gay guy that he said this to privately, or it's hearsay, or it's off the cuff, and almost always the Vatican walks it back within a few days after he says it. So part of what I had to say is, look, unless it's written down, or it's said in really an official pronouncement, you know, like even an audience, it really doesn't have any doctrinal weight and is of not much use, you know, to LGBTQ people, many of whom are suffering and very vulnerable throughout the world, vulnerable to imprisonment, to getting beaten, to losing their jobs, right, losing rights, getting killed. So that's really significant for me. So I had to say that. And I have to say, and I will say it and say it again, that until the Catholic Church says that we are entitled to sacramental marriage, we will not have justice, honestly, because we're still being told that we are against God's plan for humanity, that our love is unnatural and against is not what God wants. That's pretty heavy. And as I said in that piece, you know, I've been out loud and proud for all these years, over a dozen years, and even that creates shame for me. You know, for someone like me. So what does it do for people who are still not sure how they feel about their sexual orientation? Not to be able to get married in my own church, that creates shame, even for the strongest of us. And it's really important, you know, when you're a mother of, say, four kids and three of them can get married in the church and one can't, what does that say? What does that communicate to a parent? Right.
Yeah, there's something wrong with that fourth kid. That's what it says.
Exactly. That they are, there's something perverse and unnatural about their love. And unfortunately, Francis really idolizes heterosexual marriage with heterosexual couples with in marriage with children. And he pits us, whether he knows it or not, he pits us queer people against that. And it's not fair. And it does a lot of harm spiritually, physically. It puts people in danger. So that's sort of what I wanted people to take a look at in that piece.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What else is Francis missing about women, queer people, humanity? What is Francis missing?
Missing women. I'll tell you that. He's really, and that's been something I've been beating that drum from literally 1 month into his papacy. I've been on him about that too. Because it's so significant, you know, he still believes in gender complementarity. He believes in strict gender roles. He believes that men are meant to be leaders and women are meant to be servants, and nurturers and mothers. And that has huge global ramifications because he will say men and women are equal in dignity, but they're not equal. Just they're not equal, and they're certainly not entitled to equal roles. The ramifications of that is what I say all the time, is that think about how women suffer disproportionately throughout the world. They suffer disproportionately from lack of education, from violence, from abuse, from poverty, from trafficking. Why? Because of a patriarchal structure that says women are not equal to men. Women don't deserve the things that men deserve. That's what we're saying. And that's what Francis is saying every time he reasserts this gender binary, this gender complementarity. And this is a man who his number one, mission in life seems to be lifting up the poor, getting justice for the broken, for the marginalized. And he's contributing to it in this massive way. He's contributing to this harm, to this poverty, to this exclusion, to this disproportionate suffering every time he refuses to say women are equal. He's reasserting a patriarchal structure that is crushing women and all people of all marginalized genders. So I wish he could make that connection between women's equality and women's disproportionate suffering and the power he could have. Everyone wants to get on his list, to visit him. And the Vatican is its own diplomatic force. It has permanent observer status in the UN. It has diplomatic relations with every country. It is a powerful entity and it enjoys power that no other religious organization does. So he could really be a force if he used it for in that way. Mm-hmm. I wish he would make those connections. He cannot seem to, though.
Do you think Pope Francis reads your columns?
No, I have my suspicions. And this is why, people are going to think I sound crazy, but when I was in Rome last year, you may remember this German kid threw a Pachamama statue into the Tiber River. He started batting them into the river because it was during the Synod on the Amazon.
Yes. Okay.
All of these indigenous people from the Amazon came, with their feather headdresses and their indigenous outfits and their indigenous statues. And one was a Pachamama. It was a pregnant woman. I think she was bare-breasted, and all these arch conservative European and American men lost their minds at this disgrace, this idolatry. So they put the statue, while the synod was going on, they put the statues in, I think it was Santa Maria Trespontina in church just down the street from St. Peter's. So this kid, this young Austrian kid, he wasn't German, Austrian, breaks in the church and somebody films this. He takes these statues, these very sacred objects of these indigenous people, lines them up on the banister in front of the river and bats them one by one. And it sort of was just a blip at the Vatican. Now I was in the press, I had a press pass and I was in all the press conferences. Well, I lost my damn mind in my column. And I was like, this is an act of terrorism. This is an act of violence. This is a radical act of neocolonialism and racism. And I just lost it. And the Vatican wasn't saying anything about it. And after we published that column, the next morning, Francis made a statement about it. And I was like, I think you're reading my column, or somebody is, because no one else was saying that. I was watching everybody. I was the only one saying it. And I really called them out. And so this is my one evidence that I hang on to, that he was reading my column.
That sounds like solid evidence to me. Congratulations. well, and like you said, somebody is. Certainly somebody is. Somebody who has.
Someone that's advising him. Right?
So it sounds like for you, when we get these little drips and drabs of hearsay, side comments, he said this to me about some shred of a dignified statement about LGBTQ persons.
Right.
That is not nearly enough for Jamie Manson, it sounds like.
No, we deserve more. We deserve justice, for heaven's sakes, like everyone else, like every other vulnerable person does. The fact is, the reason that we're suffering and the reason we're in danger is because of church teaching and the power of church teaching, right? Look at Poland. They're rabidly anti-gay and they have bishops backing them up. Same thing. In Russia, The patriarch is insanely homophobic. It's religious teaching that's making us vulnerable. And so we deserve justice. As any other vulnerable population or marginalized population that the Pope fights for, we should be among them, especially since the cause of our problems is the church. I wrote a piece a few years ago, we don't need mercy, we need justice. You know, because the Pope was always talking about LGBTQ people, now, well, they need mercy, bring them in, treat them, you know, with mercy. And like, I don't need mercy. If anything, you should be asking for my mercy, given what you're doing to us. You know, we should be the one dispensing mercy to you. Yeah, we deserve justice. So it's never going to be enough until we are safe and that we are equal.
Indeed. So. Can we transition a little bit to talk about you personally, Jamie?
Yes.
The listener is hearing about all of this conflict, confrontation, and how do you personally find the courage, the strength, the perseverance to stay in this fight? And I don't necessarily mean stay Catholic, but stay publicly, professionally Catholic and publicly, professionally in this fight.
Well, I felt a certain obligation. You know, I had that platform in the National Catholic Reporter. And it was very powerful. Very few women get a platform in the Catholic media. Almost no progressive women get a platform. I was the only out lesbian, still am, journalist in the world, in the Catholic media. I'm not in the Catholic media anymore, but up until last month, I was. And I was a, you know, out loud advocate for women's ordination. Nobody gets that either. That is even more in many, fighting for women's ordination is much more nuclear than fighting for LGBTQ inclusion. Why? Because LGBTQ inclusion includes men, and men, you know, men have a way of understanding when men need justice. So, but women's ordination, forget it. Nobody wants to hear about that, you know? Because it's strictly a women's issue and an issue of people of marginalized genders as well. So I felt on my worst days, I just felt this incredible obligation to keep speaking because I couldn't squander that platform, you know? Even though I wasn't making a full salary, I was getting no benefits. The letters I would get from my readers were so powerful and so compelling and like, we're so grateful for you. You know, and what you're doing, and it means so much. You keep me in my faith. I mean, when people tell you that, you feel like, wow, I've got to keep doing this. Because to me, that's God talking to you. You know, if you know, the Spirit is moving in you that way. That's God recalling you and calling you again and calling you again. And so that really, you know, gave me strength. Yeah, that's how I went on. It was really some days because I really loved it because I felt I was right. But a lot of days it was just, I have to do this because no other woman like me or queer person like me has this platform. So.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of God.
Yeah. What about her?
When I was reading about you and I read that you did not grow up particularly observant, correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Right. Right.
So what happened?
What happened to me? Man, I don't know. I lost my mind. Well, two things happened. First, my earliest memory of church is my first Holy Communion. My mother was divorced from my father and had remarried outside the church. She asked the pastor of our church out on Long Island if she could receive communion at my first Holy Communion. And he said, absolutely not. You are excommunicated. So my mother was the only parent that did not receive communion at my first Holy Communion. And I remember it, you know, I remember turning around and seeing all the parents getting up and filing up toward the front of the altar to get their bread. And my mother sitting there on her knees, looking ashamed. And I remember it so well. So that was my first thing. I think in some ways that was sort of the beginning that sort of planted a seed in my brain. And then when I was about 13 or 14, I was at my first Holy Thursday liturgy. My mother put me in Catholic school when I was in seventh grade. First Holy Thursday liturgy. And I was just swept away by the sounds and the smells and the just, it's a very powerful liturgy. It's a singular liturgy in the church year. You know, it's the celebration of the priesthood of all believers, first of all. It's a night with rituals that we'd never ever see any other day of the year, a foot washing, a stripping of the altar, a removal of the body of Jesus from the church, a procession, chanting. So this church we were at out on Long Island did liturgy really well. And so it was particularly, the sensuality of it was so overpowering. It was intoxicating, really. Yeah. And I had this experience where I watching the procession, the Eucharistic procession, watching the priest with all of these fragments of the Eucharist walking around, and they're chanting Pange Lingua, and this, and there's smoke. The incense is really, really puffing away. And I had this experience where I felt a kind of afraid, but also utterly captivated. Mm-hmm. And I felt transported in a way, like it was a transcendent moment. And I knew that I felt this immediate sense that I had to dedicate my life to the Eucharist. And so I decided I was called to be a Catholic priest. Right there and then. And it went so well for me, as you could imagine. I was embraced so warmly by the priests and bishop, and it was great. it was not. I got turned away and laughed at a lot. But I persisted nevertheless, right? So, in time, as I went to a Catholic high school where I was taught by Vatican II teachers. They were very cool and rabble rousers. And they encouraged me. They never told me I was wrong. They never told me I shouldn't be a priest. Had great theological education even in high school. That's where I think people are, the real pariahs are formed in liberal Catholic high schools, I think. And so it was so formative when you get kids that young with these ideas of social justice. That's where it started. And then I ended up going into academia, and studying, and then becoming an activist and a journalist activist, and now a full-time activist, I guess, is what I do. So yeah, that's kind of been the journey, but it started with a calling to the priesthood, and it's still very much there, it's all ultimately ministry for me, So yeah, that's where it all comes from.
Beautifully stated. Two more questions.
Sure.
You worked with the homeless at a certain point in your journey.
Mm-hmm.
And what can you say about your biggest takeaways about being in regular contact with people who have really fallen to the fringes and are mm-hmm. unhoused?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I worked with the homeless twice. Once I was a pastoral associate at St. Francis Xavier Church in Manhattan. It's a pretty well-known church. And we did a pretty radical welcome to the homeless there. By that, I mean, we left the church doors unlocked most of the day. Homeless were welcome to sit there, have a sandwich, do whatever, sleep, whatever they had to do in the pews. And then we had this welcome table that was, they would feed 900 people every Sunday with a hot lunch and give them clothes and toiletries. And it was a really powerful experience for me, because as pastoral associate, I was prepping people for all the sacraments and, constantly reminded the fact that I was not a priest and I had no real authority, and Catholics don't realize how much they do that. It wasn't even the clericalism of the clergy that ended up breaking my spirit in that ministry. It was the clericalism of the laity, who in these little bunch of microaggressions would remind me that I had no real authority in the church, even though I had my MDiv, I did everything I needed. I just didn't have the body part. Essentially, that was all I was missing.
Yes.
And being the church, so St. Francis Xavier has this thing called upstairs church and downstairs church. And upstairs church is where, the main church where the sacraments are celebrated, and downstairs church was that welcome table. And so as you were at mass during Sunday, you would start to smell that soup. And it was again, very sensual, sacramental experience.
Mm-hmm.
But what that taught me was when I was done with my day, and they were crushing days, because I was doing all my ministries in one day, RCIA, family, faith, baptizing kids, everything would happen in like this 4-hour, window. I would be so spent and feeling so vulnerable at the end of each Sunday that I would go downstairs and I would just bust plates and serve extra coffee to the homeless people downstairs. And I was just so struck at, they didn't care if I was a priest, or they didn't know about my gender, my sexual orientation, my anything. It was just, was I present, and that's all that mattered, you know, was my presence. And I felt like, you know, we have a sacramental view of the world as Catholics, and this is as much Eucharist down here as it is upstairs. Mm-hmm. Right. So it really got me to see that the whole table. Kenan Osborne, the liturgical theologian, says that if you don't see Jesus in the table of the world, you will not see Jesus in the table of the Eucharist. And so I really got to see that this, the whole, when you really have a Catholic sacramental view of the world, everything is sacrament. Everything can be Eucharist. There's no distinction really between small S and capital S sacraments when you really start to embrace that view. So that was really helpful for me. What I also learned was the beauty of the Catholic sacramental vision is that you don't just see God in beauty and in joy and in glorious things and sunsets and babies being born and all these things. You also can see God in absolute brokenness and desolation.
Yeah.
That's something nuns taught me. Reading Dorothy Day taught me. And that's a real gift when you're dealing with that level of pain and suffering, when you're shouldering that for people, which is what you do when you work with any broken people, any broken population. You can see the crucified Christ in people, and you can see, you know, it gives everything just so much more meaning, you know, and that was really important for me as well, is that it really expanded my sacramental vision, to say that, you know, God is also in this brokenness and God is suffering with this person and God is being crucified over and over again with the radical injustices these people face and the abuses these people have faced, and the mental illness that is an absolute crucifixion for people, and the drugs they use to medicate that pain because they don't have resources is a crucifixion of these people. Mm-hmm. So that sort of, you know, and I don't mean in a way to fetish. I think sometimes Catholics can fetishize the poor in a really unhealthy way, you know, and see them as Christ and, oh, they're real people really suffering. And many of them are very difficult and they're a tough population. I happen to love them. They were my charism, but you know, we all have our groups that we love. But yeah, it was really, so just that broadening for me of really seeing sacrament everywhere.
So what is feeding your spirituality these days?
Oh man, that's hard to say. You know, part of the struggle with moving away is I kind of left my little ragtag Catholic on the margin groups. Now that was easier to do because of COVID, because I haven't been in touch with them anyway. So in a kind of a disturbing way, it was easier to move because I guess I don't feel connected with those communities. I guess it doesn't feel real, you know? But they are really the nourishment I get, you know, that spirituality. So I have my Dignity, New York chapter of Dignity USA, which is an LGBTQ Catholic group. They're cool. They let women preach and preside at Eucharist. They let women be priests, which is really nice. And then I have the Ben and Casa community in New York City, which is an intentional community that has a liturgy every month. They're just, I think, getting back to some sort of limited in-person liturgy. So they really do, you know, keep me going. For sure. The folks I'm working with now, I have a wonderful, wonderful team that I'm working with at Catholics for Choice. They're bright and they're just so committed and smart, you know, just smart. And they really, really care about the suffering that is being caused, you know, by this doctrine. And so that, you know, to see that level of dedication and commitment is very, very nourishing also. And I have a wonderful partner. I'm really, really lucky. You know, she's bright and she's funny. She supports me in everything I do. And that's really important. That gives an element of stability, I think, that, you know, I need. You know, I've always suffered from depression and anxiety and all these things, and just having that basic sense of stability and security in the and is really, really wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, it helps you really thrive. And she has a wonderful family. I have a great, wonderful mother, you know, who now is no longer believes she is excommunicated. She receives communion, damn it. No matter what, she has come to, you know, the light that no one controls the table of Jesus. Mm-hmm. That it belongs to Jesus. And so I have this wonderful mom who's really supportive, and friends, and my partner's family. It's really lovely. So it's great. You know, I think all those elements are really keep me afloat, you know, and keep me going.
Yeah. Jamie, thank you so much for talking.
Pleasure. Oh, it was so much fun. I loved it.
Thanks for listening to On a Mission. If you enjoyed Jamie's spiritual sensibility, she is offering an Advent retreat on Sunday, December 13th, 2020, from 4 to 5:30 p.m. Eastern. Join Jamie in a call for self-care and spiritual practice. It's part of Call to Action's larger series of Advent offerings for 2020. Wow, what a robust collection of resources they have pulled together. Get all of the details at my website, MaleneDupreeDominguez.com. There you will also find the show notes for this episode. I'll put in links to all of the writings Jamie mentioned, along with a link to Catholics for Choice and Dignity USA. While you're there, make sure you sign up for my weekly email newsletter, which contains prayer tools, cool stuff to read, and links to other progressive faith-based stuff around the internet. This episode caps off season 2 of On a Mission. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these inspired souls as much as I have enjoyed talking with them. Until season 3, may you be blessed with energy and vision to live your mission. Peace.